Welcome to the History of Networking, where we drag all the skeletons out of the wiring closet and ponder the ghosts of protocols past. Today, we are talking to Dr. Doug Comer about the history of TCP/IP. So grab a pile of cookies, settle in, and listen as we meld with the finest minds in networking.
Dr. Comer, great to have you on the History of Networking. We're all big fans of your work. In fact, when I first started Cisco Tech in 96, many, many years ago, they gave me three books to read. And you probably know which three they were. Radio Perlman, Comer, and Tannenbaum. And I still remember to this day Tannenbaum's illustration of the station wagon full of VHS tapes for whatever reason. So why don't we begin with how you actually got into networking? Because, it was a much less prominent or much less, there were no degree programs in networking when you came into this field, I assume. Like there weren't when I came in either. So I'm just dating myself there.
Yeah, so there were no degree programs. I didn't have any networking courses. I was a professor, starting out as assistant professor, and one day Digital Equipment Corporation came by and they said, we've got these old, tiny little computers, we're giving them away. Now, when I say tiny, I'm talking 8K bytes of RAM. And they were very slow. They were little PDP-11s. And I took them. I agreed to take them and play with them because in those days we had mainframes. We didn't have access to real computers. I, by the way, was a computer science professor, but, we didn't use real computers. So I got the little computers. I built an operating system, which I wrote a book about. And that book is fairly well known. I also decided I wanted to see if I could make these computers connect together and talk. So I hooked up the only physical connectors they had were serial lines. I hooked them up. I built protocols. I did this little tiny network. It was all amateur, I didn't know anything. But I was able to send messages from one computer to another. Along about then, the head of the department, Peter Denning, and some of his friends decided to have a project called CSNet. They said we should connect all of the computer science departments together on a network. Now, that probably sounds obvious and, boring.
Dangerous.
But you can't imagine in those days how many people stood up and said, that's dumb. Why would anybody need a network? So the politics of the day were that computer scientists were against the internet. I had several people tell me, Doug, you're going wrong. Your whole career will go down the tubes, because one guy, very, very fatherly advice, he wasn't being mean, he said to me, took me aside, he put his arm around my shoulder. The kind of fatherly advice you get from a senior guy? He said, Doug, networking has never been part of computer science and never will be. No one will be interested in that. And he was giving me this warning. Your career is going to die. You're never going to get full professor. So I worked on the CSNet project. I worked on the proposal, and my first encounter with the internet guys, I had to figure out, I was the quote protocol guy on the internet, on the CSNet part of the project. And we were going to use the internet protocols, TCP/IP, which, by the way, were just being invented. So TCP and IP were separated from one another in 1978. In 1979, I started working on the proposal for CSNet. So think, very early days, Nobody knew anything.
We still don't, by the way. We just pretend.
I'm actually a bit curious why networking wasn't considered computer science.
Well, computer science had been owned by mathematicians. Almost everyone, when I went to grad school, almost every professor had a PhD in math. They had come over from mathematics to work in computers. So things like theory of computation, I'm talking hardcore theory, and numerical analysis were the big topics. So you were either on the numerical analysis side, which meant that you were doing computer versions of differential equations or integrals or, you know, root finding, that kind of stuff, or the theory world. And when I went to grad school, the theory courses were unbelievable. We had a whole course in language theory. Now, you're probably thinking programming languages. No. This is the mathematical theory of languages. We had a course in automata theory. We had a course in finite state automata, a whole course. And by the way, all we did was prove theorems. No one in that course had any notion that you could actually use it in a computer program. It was not something. One of my professors very dramatically stood up at the beginning of class when we started a class, and he said, "I don't program." And he went on to say that people who programmed were just technicians. He, on the other hand, considered himself very close to a mathematician, which, you know, in his view was very high up. So these guys own computer science. When I got to Purdue, there were people here who hated operating systems, networks, databases, none of that stuff. Oh, compilers was in there. None of that stuff should have been in computer science. In their view, it should have been kept purely about recursive function theory, about hierarchies of mathematical languages, so forth.
Wow. So that's pretty interesting, actually, that it starts from that, because you do have kind of a thing in the world today. We were just talking before we started recording that, you know, there's this thing that things are properly syntactic or whatever, syntactic in computer science. And it's almost become much more of an engineering, a strict engineering, like much more of a, does it work rather than is it mathematically correct? It's pretty interesting that we've come all that way.
Well, it was obvious to me and to other people that the real purpose of computer science was, as you point out, to engineer big, complex pieces of software. And to get there, we had to sort of wait for the old guys to go their way.
Okay. Okay, that's pretty funny, but go ahead, sorry.
So anyway, I joined the CSNet project. I was the protocol guy, and my job was to figure out how to do long-distance communication for CSNet. Unfortunately, even though they were proposing a $5 million budget, which was, for NSF in those days, absolutely huge, but nobody had $5 million projects. And, you know, remember 1970s, think about inflation and you'll see what we're talking about.
Yeah.
So here's the NSF saying $5 million connect every computer science department, and we can't build any kind of backbone infrastructure that's going to get across even the United States, let alone any departments, you know, outside Canada, England, other places. So how do we start up? The answer was, you could, in those days, get something called X.25. X.25 was an ISO standard CCITT and ISO had gotten together, written standards, and they had this standard for long distance network communication. It was basically a phone call. You had a phone number for your computer, and another computer would dial your phone, then it would send data, and then it would hang up the connection. So it was indeed computer to computer, but it was all based on, you know, the phone company's idea of connection-oriented networking. That was the only way that you could do long-distance communication. Well, we had dial-up, but dial-up was even slower.
In those 2400 baud, right? Or something even worse, I think, maybe.
No. 110, 150 baud, and you could move up to the higher speed 300 baud.
Okay, that is a lot slower.
for local connections, you could do 9600 baud, but that was really pushing it.
Wow.
So my job was to figure out, how do you do TCP/IP in this world of X25? And I came up with this idea of tunneling, put it in the proposal. I had to go give a talk to Vince Cerf and the internet guys, John Postel, you know, the hardcore five or six people who were building internet protocols. Remember, it's all brand new stuff. So it's not as if, you know, it was all done. They were figuring out how to do it. And I had to give a talk convincing them that tunneling would work. So I mustered up my strength, went down to Washington, gave the talk, and I thought I was doing pretty well. But then the reviews came in from the internet, from the proposal, the CSNet proposal that we'd put together, and they said, tunneling is a horrible idea. It'll never work. You'll never be able to send datagrams over a packet switch public network like X25. It just won't work. Now, presumably they get reviews from, you know, experts. But
I was going to say, who are the experts back then?
Yeah, who are the experts? So there must have been X25 people. You know, the X25 people hated TCP/IP. That was just those silly guys off in the corner building something on their own. That would never work. That wasn't real. So anyway, Vint let me proceed. I said, I want to do tunneling anyway. He let me proceed. The project was successful. We ran CSNet over X25 for years until NSF got enough money to build a real backbone. And my career changed course based on that.
And it got so much worse, right? and you still regret doing it? No. It's just, wow. That's a really fascinating story. So, when you were developing the whole TCP/IP stack, you had to code it. I mean, I'm assuming you coded it from ground up and everything like that. This is not commercially available software, so you're just building stuff.
So we're all building stuff. We're all building our own stuff. And everything had to be interoperable. One of the rules was you couldn't publish an RFC until you got three of your friends, or you and two of your friends, to write the software and then make sure it was interoperable. It was a wonderful way to make sure all the specifications were correct. You know, I give you a specification, you build software, and then we hook up and see if your software talks to my software correctly.
Right.
Mm-hmm. If it doesn't, then that specification isn't any good because, you know, it's obviously got holes in it. We don't understand how to do it. So that was the rule. Three independent implementations had to work, interoperate correctly, had to work and interoperate before you could publish an RFC.
And that rule still kind of exists for some protocols, but not all. Like, It depends on the working group now, but some working groups or some work streams still have that in the IETF. So it's kind of funny that that's still there. It's still the same sort of a thing.
Yeah, well, I think it's pretty easy. My theory is if you go to the working groups where that is still a rule, you'll find an old guy. Well, you know, people my age, because we're left over from the era in which that was the absolute way to build good stuff.
Yes, yes, that's probably, yeah, I mean, we still do have a lot of discussions about some of this stuff and thinking about, well, for experimentals, do you really need that? Do you need it for, you know, is that always a necessity type of thing? So those discussions still swirl around in the IETF realm or when people talk about this stuff in the IETF. Yeah. So I guess going back, I mean, you implemented this stuff. So it's you're making it sound a lot easier than it probably was. Let's be honest.
All right. So the other thing you have to remember about the early days was I spent a lot of time talking to the guys who invented and wrote the RFCs on the protocols, asking for a clarification. What happens if you connect a computer on a network and it's got the wrong IP address and somebody ARPs, should you answer or should you not? And on and on and on. I mean, just, you know, basically, what about all those thousands of corner cases?
Okay. And so, did they get mad at you or no?
No, they were, okay, so let's see. The people who worked on the internet project were both incredibly bright and incredibly open to other people's ideas and questions. It was a very collegial, it was a wonderful environment. Sometimes you wouldn't get a response right away because somebody would be working like mad, but when you got a response, it was often really insightful. You know, the guy on the other end of the communication was a real expert who, there were times, one time I was struggling. And I said, look, there's a meeting in 2 weeks. I'm going to talk to Dave Clark. My wife said, why? I was really frustrated and, you know, late at night. Said, because 10 minutes with Dave Clark will answer all my questions. And it was true. I got there. I had my questions. What about this detail? What about that detail? What about this? What about that? Could it be this? Could this be the problem? You know, here's a performance issue. And within just a short time, Dave was able to answer everything. And there was one thing that he had never heard of. He went out and ran a little test. And in 5 minutes gave me the answer. Oh, we got this wrong and you should have done that. It was, and it still is, I still prize the guys that I know because they can answer really tough questions and get to the meat of the matter quickly.
We need them.
Oh, they're still there. He's got nowhere to look.
Well, the other thing that's happened in the internet now is the big change. The big change was 1989, they called together the IAB. The IAB in those days was fewer than a dozen of us, really. And they made this announcement. They said, look, we're going to reorganize everything. We're going to reorganize the IAB. We're going to reorganize, and we're going to have this new group, the IETF, which was, you know, just a little tiny group, is going to become the main engineering group for new protocols, and Phil Gross was going to take over. And they went around the room and they asked each of us, "What do you think? You know, what's going to happen?" And I said very naively, this was 1989, not, you know, not 1979. I said, we need about 10 years of research. If DARPA would fund about 10 years, we could get a lot of things better than they are. Yeah, it works, but we could really polish this up. And Phil came across the room, sort of bounded across the room. I was sitting at one of the tables there. And he said to me, Doug, you're wrong. I was sort of shocked. What's going on? He says, Doug, you don't understand. Now there's money, and money changes everything. And when he said it, I wrote it down because I was going to come up with, you know, counter arguments that there was what he's talking about. But he was right. The companies had moved in. The Ciscos of the world were moving into the internet. They were taking control, and it was an entirely different process. So instead of researchers sitting in a corner building the best thing they could do, working for years on tiny little details to get them right, it was going to be fast and furious. And I hate to say it, but the company with the most money could have the most influence.
Yeah, you know, there was a time when people would say that essentially, that is where things went, was that the company with the most money had the most influence type of thing. To some degree, I think it's probably still true today. I mean, I hate to say it, but it's probably still true today that the company with the most money, who invests the most money in the standards process and does that kind of work and cares about it and everything, is going to have the most influence. I think we sometimes forget that in the game of building networks. And when we look at the ITF and stuff, we tend to forget that there is at least some of that that goes on in the real world still.
Oh, there's a lot of it. I mean, look at how many people a given company sends to the IETF. And some of it is very shocking.
Just in pure the number of people that go, yeah, there is that. There are a lot of companies that send 200-300 people to the IETF. I mean, the IETF only has 1,200 people on average show up at the ITF. So it's not a big group. That's something that's quite surprising to people, is that when you go to one, you're like, this is it? This is all there is. Yeah, this is it. This is all there is. And so that is kind of surprising to people. But then out of that, you'll get one company that will send 200-300 people. And you're like, well, that certainly has an outsized influence. It's got to.
Sure, but remember, the reason that we don't have 10,000 people in IETFs anymore is the internet works so well that it really doesn't need much tweaking.
Well, that hasn't stopped us from trying. We still seem to be doing a lot of it. Tweaking, that is. Something like that, whatever it is. Yeah, we seem to be doing an awful lot of tweaking on the internet today. So, yeah. So, back during that time frame, other than just not having the code, I mean, what other challenges did you have that you had to deal with at that time that seemed or might still seem very pertinent to today and how things run in the way people get things done today?
Well, let's see. Two things. One, until the late 80s, we really didn't have any money. But beyond that, we didn't believe there was ever any money in it. And that changes people's perspective. So we had a meeting in 1986. Dan Lynch showed up. And he was talking to Paul Makapetris and Dave and me, and it was the first time I ever met Dan Lynch, and he said, you know, there's got to be money in this. And we unanimously, everyone there said, oh, Dan, you don't understand. Look, IBM has their own networks. Digital Equipment Corporation has their own networks. CDC has networks. Everybody else has, and of course the phone company has networks, and you know, they all have those networks. That's the commercial network world. There was even things like banyan vines and you know, the little
oh my goodness, nightmares. Sorry.
The little computer companies. So there was what was the Apple network?
Apple Talk.
A really nice but horrible technology. It looked nice. It looked nice until you realized that it didn't extend very far and had, you couldn't ever use it with real stuff. I don't know. Did you ever, you know, how Apple Talk worked?
Well, yeah, but you can explain it because I don't want to explain it.
Well, the part I liked was that you didn't assign addresses. They got assigned automatically. After a power failure and reboot, computer would come up and it would say, let's see, I'll pick a random number. I'll be 17 today. Are there any other 17s out there? Broadcast a message. If there was, then you back off and say, okay, I'll pick a new random number. But the random number stuff in those days was hard because there wasn't a good source of randomness. So it was a pseudo random number sequence, and every computer would start with the same random number.
Yeah, nobody figured out how to seed the hash yet.
So after a power failure, you got some horrible things with collisions and everybody trying the same sequence. And so Apple Talk was a fun little thing if you had a very stable network with two or three computers on it, you know, a home network, but it didn't scale. In any case, that's where all the money was. And everybody working on the internet project believed that. We had been told again and again and again, you guys are doing fun stuff off in the corner. That's fine for you scientists, but you know, the real stuff is the commercial stuff. So,
yeah, well,
well, no,
and it's true to a large degree, right? It is true.
You can't imagine the world back then. You just can't imagine how people talked about the internet as a joke. The other thing I'll tell you is that in those days I was going to Bell Labs, talking to my friends at Bell Labs. I had done some work that came to their attention early in my career. And so I got invited back several times. And I would go, I was working on the internet project, and they would tell me, we're talking about 1127. This is the top research group. Every name you've ever heard at Bell Labs was in 1127. And they would carefully explain to me why packet switching was such a dumb idea. No one would ever use that. And they had, remember, they had 7 Nobel laureates at Bell Labs. In the history of Bell Labs, they had mathematical prize winners. They had, you know, they had all of the sort of
smart people that everybody looked up to and said,
yeah,
this is really the people. These are really the people who know what's going on.
Yeah. And they had done a lot of the basic work on things like information theory, Shannon, Nyquist, all of that early stuff. So they thought they understood how to do everything, and they had decided on circuit switch networks. Packet switching was just a silly idea. They would pick on things like Ethernet. So here's one of their arguments. Look, we at Bell Labs know how to build a network. If you look at the way we multiplex voice signals, every bit is used. You look at a wire at the center of the phone company, it's synchronous. It's actually isochronous, but it's a synchronous protocol, and every bit is filled. There are no blank bits. Now let's look at Ethernet. Computer sends a packet. What happens next? There is an inter-packet gap. Before you send the next packet, you must wait. What happens on the wire during that time? Hey, it's dead air. You're not using that bandwidth.
Are you kidding me? You're going to waste time on a wire because you have packets instead of nice synchronous stuff like we have?
You know, it's funny is I actually remember those arguments because I was in the Air Force at the time, and we were having those arguments over whether to deploy synchronous or asynchronous, you know, synchronous or packet switch networks. And I actually had a guy tell me once, he said, you know, we were working on a synchronous network. And he said, I'm telling you, we are deploying the fastest network that you will ever see in networking right now, because this is a synchronous network and it works the way networks should work. And like, okay. I mean, I don't know what I'm doing. So what do I do? Right. I say, okay, well, cool. Maybe I should go do synchronous networks, but thankfully I didn't.
Yeah, well, the other thing that you can't imagine is if you had ever taken a networking course, if you had ever read a book, they were all based on the old telephone model. They were not, you know, the internet guys were off in a corner. That was unusual. All of the textbooks, all of the engineering had been done for telephone networks. And so, you know, if you grew up in that world and you asked, what do the experts think? They all think circuit switching is the way to go, except for these guys over in the corner here. You know, half a dozen people sitting in a room trying to build packet switch networks. And it's hard. It's really hard to get a flavor for it. Imagine that every expert in the world is lined up against it. Now, here's the fun part. Flash forward to the year 2000. In the year 2000, there was an earthquake that nobody noticed except for me. After all that time arguing with the guys at Bell Labs, in the year 2000, AT&T came out with an announcement. It would never again buy an ESS number 4, ESS number 5 circuit switch. From then on, it was doing everything with IP routers. It was going to change the entire phone system to be based on IP. Imagine my shock when I heard that.
Because that's totally radically changing the entire world at that time.
I thought the phone companies were so ingrained that they would never, ever change from circuit switched. But, you know, by then it was really obvious that packet switching, despite not using every bit time on a wire, was much, much cheaper.
Right, and a lot of times what we forget is what is more efficient is not necessarily better just because it's more efficient. We go after the efficiency issue, and we don't tend to think in terms of not just what's more efficient, but what is, how would you put it, more just better overall, like better fit to purpose or something like that. Like, I don't know exactly how to say it, but something in that range.
Well, it's more of like an economic question at that point in time, right? If I have a choice between spending $1 million or $100,000 and getting the same performance.
Right. Exactly. Yep.
Well, so, here was the difference. The circuit switches in those days, year 2000, an ESS number 5, I believe, circuit switch, the base price was $20 million. And if you go over to the IP world and ask, how many IP routers can I get for $20 million? Oh, you could get a whole lot of IP routers. So yes, it was an economic question, but the other side of it was the technology was so much better. Do you know that in the 1980s, the phone companies said, hey, we want to have this new service. It's going to be called call forwarding, you know? Sounds pretty radical. How long did it take them from start to finish to put call forwarding in the network?
I would imagine it was years.
It took a decade. And that was just to get some of it rolled out. There were still switches 3 decades later that hadn't been upgraded to call forwarding. That's because the design, the way the phone system was designed, the switch knew everything. You want to change the service? You have to change every switch in the universe. Now, go to IP. Hey, we decided to have a new service. Let's call it the World Wide Web. How many routers have to change to do the World Wide Web? Oh, zero. All you do is hook up a computer, put World Wide Web software on it, hook up another computer at the other end, put a browser on it, and presto, it's done. You don't have to change the network to add new services. So economics, yeah, it's economics, but it's not just the cost of individual pieces of hardware. The economics of the situation have to do with how long it takes to roll out new services, how much flexibility you have. It's an amazing difference.
Right. Yeah. I mean, even today we talk about edge compute and stuff like that. And when I was working a while back at Ericsson, there was a big issue about AT&T and trying to replace the COs. And, you know, the IP technology they were trying to replace the COs with was more expensive than the switches, even at that time. And people say, why are you doing this? Because the truck roll of deploying a new service to an end user is so much more expensive that it covers the differential in cost and complexity 10 times over very quickly, just trying to get those new services rolled out. So yeah, it's I think we often forget how flexible packet switching really is and the way it works.
Yeah, the other side of it is, you know, in the early days, the phone companies believed that voice would be around forever, but this business of data, that was just an add-on. That wasn't their main product, their main service that they offered was voice. And so they did things like ISDN, but that was really an afterthought. Hey, let's tie together a couple of voice channels and put bits over them and let the users send data. But the internet turns it around. The internet says, hey, data is the center of the universe and voice is just yet another little application on top.
Right. Yep. Yep. So Donald, do you have any striking questions you want to ask before we give up? And
no, actually, I think I'm pretty good.
You think you're pretty good?
Pretty good.
You're pretty good. Okay, cool. Well, Dr. Kummer, I guess we will let you have the rest of your afternoon back. Thanks very much for joining us. And can anybody find your work? I know you still teach at Purdue. Do you have a web page or anything people can dig around and find and see what you're up to now?
Well, there's a web page, but I don't keep my latest projects online because I have the opposite problem than most people. My problem is, if I put anything out there, the next thing I know, there are lots of people all around the world asking questions and wanting my time, and I really don't have much time to give them. So if somebody really wants to know what I'm up to, I will tell them, send me email. But, you know, I'm trying to avoid the situation where people don't, you know, get answers for 3 or 4 weeks because I'm so inundated with things to do.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense, actually. So that's cool. And Donald, you are at, what's your Twitter?
Me Not You Sharp.
Me Not You Sharp. There you go.
Yeah.
So cool. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Kummer, for coming on. And we'll get this all patched up and set up to be sent out in a couple, it'll probably take about a month or so, might be a little bit longer because I'm running behind on getting these things published, but that's all good. And maybe we'll have you back on sometime to talk about, I don't know, some other part of history that you were deeply involved in. So
sure. That would be good.
Yep. Thank you very much. And you have a great afternoon.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The History of Networking. Please join us for future episodes as we chronicle the origins of many of the technologies that make up the modern internet.